I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Hetha Prabhakar. She's a journalist, she's a Bloomberg TV correspondent, and she's author of the new book, Black Market Billions, How Organized Retail Crime Funds Global Terrorists. And she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night, Thursday, the 5th of March, at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So I've heard of organized crime. I'd never heard of organized retail crime. What is it?
Right. Well, organized retail crime is a specific, it really has to do with people that go into stores, groups of people. You know, they kind of function in, you know, maybe 4 to 6 groups of people. They go in collectively and go into stores anywhere ranging from high-end stores like a Nordstrom or Saks Fifth Avenue or Neiman Marcus all the way down to a Walmart or Walgreens. And they kind of go in as a group. They take maybe, you know, 15 minutes or even less and steal items just off the shelves, put them in bags, and walk out. So it's the organized retail crime aspect of it is really has to do with the fact that these are organized groups that go in together and go in and steal items and then take those items and sell that for profit.
It turns out that this is a huge, huge business in the billions every year, just in the United States alone.
Oh, yeah, $38 billion, I think, for 2010, and that number is going up for 2011. So, yeah, it is a huge business. And that's right, we're just talking about the United States. I mean, globally, it's, you know, exponentially larger.
Now, who are these people? Are they associated with other kinds of organized crime, like drug trafficking and so on?
Well, it's interesting. There are different facets of these types of groups. So when I was writing my book, I, you know, interviewed a bunch of people from loss prevention executives to, you know, FBI, members of the FBI, to members of Immigration Customs Enforcement. And what loss prevention, it was really Jerry Biggs, who I had worked with, who was at Walgreens, and he was explaining to me that there are different levels of these types of groups. So the level one, you know, these types of people, they, you know, sometimes have drug problems. They're just sort of going in, just needing money for petty purchases. And they maybe go in, you know, 2 or 3 at a time, go into a store, steal some items or, you know, steal receipts and try to steal items and then return those items on those receipts. You know, just really petty stuff. They're not making that much money. They're just trying to fund, like, quick fixes, right?
And you can barely call that organized crime.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, organized in the sense that they're kind of going in as a group, but, you know, that's not an organized crime group, you know, on the larger level. However, some of these bigger groups, when you get to the level 2 and the level 3 organized retail crime, the level 3 boosters and the level 3 fencers, they use these petty guys to go in and steal those items. Sometimes, you know, they'll put them out on the road and have them hit several stores at a time. So, you know, what I thought was interesting and what, you know, I sort of observed were these groups of people that would go up and down the Eastern Seaboard, you know, take a trip for like 3 weeks, for example, go up, hit several Walgreens stores in different states, and steal the same items. So whether that's Crest White strips or you heard about this Tide, all of a sudden people are starting to steal Tide because they're easy to sell. They're
detergent.
Know, detergent, right. I mean, you go into a store and Tide goes for $10 a bottle. You know, resale, you know, if they go and sell that at a flea market or on, you know, online, for example, they may not sell it for $10, but if they sell it for $6, people go there thinking they're getting a discount, but that's, you know, $6 that are in their pocket that wasn't there before. Now, if you multiply that by several 20 or 30, you know, Tide bottles, and you multiply that by, you know, 15 stores that they're hitting every single day, I mean, it becomes a huge amount of money that these people are doing. So that's the organized crime aspect of it. Now, also, so I'm going to try to paint the picture for you. So you have these little guys that are going in and maybe stealing a couple items here and there. Then you have the level 2 guys that go in and kind of function, go up and down the Eastern Seaboard and steal the items. They might, you know, steal these items and then they're part of a bigger group. And these level 3 guys that go in, oversee the level 2s, take all that money, take the money that they're getting from the sale of these items. You know, they're the ones that kind of put them in fake warehouses, resell them at flea markets, resell them online. And then maybe pay a percentage out to these level two people that were stealing for them. So the level, so it's different levels. These level three guys, the ones up top, the ones that are really kind of raking in the millions of dollars from all the stolen merchandise. So if you think about it, going up and down the Eastern Seaboard and stealing from several stores over 3 weeks periods, you know, with 2 weeks in between for a break, I mean, that can garner you, you know, $2 to $3 million a year. So if you have all these different groups that are doing that, well, that's how you get to the $38 billion.
I mean, it's hard to believe that stealing laundry detergent and toothpaste strips and things like that can make so much money. And, of course, that's not all of it. You talk in the book about handbags and shoes and things like that as well.
Right, right. We start up the book where someone tries to offer me a stolen handbag.
Right.
And it was actually a colleague of mine at my former job. He said to me, hey, listen, do you want to buy this Givenchy handbag? I have it. You can buy it off of me. It's real for $300. And I have a Lanvin handbag, which is, you know, at Barney's. It sells for upwards of $1,400. And he was going to sell that to me for $400. Now, you know, having worked in retail and covered retail for, you know, six plus years now, I know that the markup on those handbags, they don't go for $300 or $400 unless they're A, fake, or B, stolen. So I asked him about that. I said, where did you get them? And then he proceeds to explain to me where he got them. And he explains that they're coming from a group, an organized group in Barney's, which was the store in New York City that this group was functioning in. And what they would do is steal from the store and then sell, you know, maybe steal 10 or 12 bags a week or so, and then sell that on the black market to unassuming women like me. Now, this was right at the cusp of the recession. You know, women, you know, who had aspirational, you know, they had aspirational thoughts of, you know, buying handbags, you know, a lot of they really kind of targeted that aspirational customer. And what I mean by that is that woman that, you know, maybe makes, you know, $60,000 to $70,000 a year, can't afford a $1,400 bag every 2 weeks, but maybe wants one once a year, but sees this opportunity to buy a real one for $400. Well, she's going to jump on it if she doesn't know better. So when that happened to me, I A, wanted to document it, and B, wanted to deep dive into this more. I mean, if it's happening in a store like Barney's, then where else is it happening? And as I map out in my book, you know, it's happening virtually everywhere.
Everywhere, all the time. So this is a kind of organized crime. It's happening all over the place. You've given some examples. But what's the connection? I mean, your book, the subtitle of your book is about global terrorists. What's going on in terms of the terrorist piece?
Well, as you know, we just had this recession. We're kind of coming out, you know, economists are saying, oh, we're, you know, coming at the end of this recession, you know, they go back and forth, you know, from what I, you know, looking at the Dow, having covered financial markets, it looks as if we're on the back end of this recession. But at the time, you know, when I started writing this book, 2007, 2008, everyone was getting hit by the recession. People had to pull back on their spending and the money that they were making. And that also affected groups like the Al-Qaeda, believe it or not, and the Hezbollah. People, you know, a lot of that money comes from wealthy donations and, you know, drug sales and, you know, horrible things like human trafficking and, but mostly sales of drugs. And they, too, were experiencing a shortage in funds. So what was really happening is that they were looking for means to make a lot of money quickly, but make it so that they didn't, there wasn't a huge, there wasn't a criminal trail. So when you're, and the way that, when I interviewed someone from the FBI, the way he put it is that if someone is caught selling $1 million worth of cocaine, the ramifications legally are going to be much stricter than if they're caught selling or selling $1 million worth of stolen jeans. So, and that's part of the problem here. I think what was really going on was that, you know, a lot of these groups, especially what I really focused in on was the Hezbollah in Latin America, because it's so
now
easy.
The Hezbollah in Latin America.
Right. Well, I know. And that's what, you know, when I say that, people are like, what are you talking about? The Hezbollah isn't there. What are you talking about? But, you know, we really looked at this area in Latin America, and this is the tri-border area. This is where Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil sort of intersect. And it's Ciudad del Este. And what was happening there was that there was a mall owned by members of the Hezbollah, basically. They had connections to the Hezbollah. And what they were doing is that they were stealing items like Sony PlayStation 2s and selling them, reselling them, you know, shipping them back to this mall, into the stores, and reselling them to fund their Hezbollah cell there. So that's what this, that's what, when I mean that that's how terrorists are being funded, this is how it's happening. And it's easy for them to do. It's not a hard thing for them to just go and steal, you know, boxes of Sony PlayStation 2s, ship them overseas. There's no real regulation on that. And that's what I wanted to point out in this book. As a consumer, you don't really know what's regulated and what's not. You just want a good deal. And on the other side, on the, you know, on the legal side, on the, you know, on the regulation side, they're having a hard time too, because there's no way to track that merchandise. So it's really it needs to be regulated on both sides. Consumers need to take charge and really kind of see where their money is going and really kind of be wary of where, what they're buying. And on the same time, organizations like the Immigration Customs Enforcement and FBI need to be more diligent about where this merchandise is coming from.
We're talking to Heather Prabhakar about her book, Black Market Billions. So you've talked about Hezbollah. What other terrorist organizations are you looking at in this book and are being funded by the theft of retail merchandise?
Well, what's really interesting is that you remember journalist Daniel Pearl, correct? So I was reading parts of his book, and he was saying, you know, right around the time of his death, he was working on a story about televisions that were coming out of Afghanistan, and they were contraband televisions. What I mean by that they weren't regulated televisions that were being sold. They were coming in through Afghanistan and being sold in Pakistan, and they were unregulated. They were Sony televisions setups. I can't remember exactly which television they were. They weren't flat screens.
Right.
They were these, you know, television
TV sets. TV sets.
I
have at home.
Exactly. Like you would have at home. So they were coming in from Afghanistan and going in to Pakistan, being sold through Pakistan. And there weren't any tariffs on that. You know, the organization that was kind of shepherding them through was taking money in order for them to get to have those television sets, go through Afghanistan into Pakistan. So that was one way. And that's, you know, that was funding right there, the Taliban. I mean, Taliban was engrossed in that and involved in that. So in that aspect, you know, we're talking about illegal ways of getting merchandise from one place to another and taking funds in order to get that illegal merchandise from one place to another. So there's that one aspect. I mean, I want to try to like condense it down so it's, you know, easy for your listeners to sort of understand the whole aspect of it. But it's, you know, that's one aspect of it. There's another aspect where we talk about these drug cartels, for example. These drug cartels have, you know, we're talking about the level 2 boosters, for example. They send out their little guys out.
Now, booster, just define that word.
Oh, sure. So these are the guys that kind of go out and they're assigned to go in and steal merchandise from a store.
So if I'm a booster, I'm the person who goes in with a big old handbag, puts stuff in it, and walks out.
Right, but I have to point out one thing about your handbag. It's going to be lined with tinfoil because the tinfoil doesn't set off the alarms, believe it or not. So,
amazing.
Yes. So it's a big old handbag or a big old shopping bag that looks completely inconspicuous. They go into the stores, and they go and fill it up with, you know, little items or even big items sometimes, but it takes them anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes. They go in, leave the store, and then they go back out and, you know, sell it to the big guys, you know, the level 3 guys, or they bring it back to the level 3 guys, back to their warehouses. Level 3 guys may have affiliations to these, you know, larger organizations, like I was saying, the Hezbollah or the Al-Qaeda, or in some instances, they might even be, you know, having, you know, ties back to these drug cartels, which in turn have these ties back to, you know, these Mexican mafia or, you know, these Mexican Marxist movements that are happening in Mexico. And that's how they get their funding that way.
So we have a world, I mean, we know that in the past we've known that terrorism has been in different places funded by human trafficking and drug trafficking. How big a piece of the total funding of these organizations is organized retail crime.
Well, I think overall it's not that big. I think when you look at terrorism, it's still funded by donors. It's still funded by drugs and drug trafficking. It's, you know, funded by, you know, other things, human trafficking, that kind of thing. But organized retail crime, and what I wanted to and what I wanted to kind of point out here is that while it might not be as big as drug trafficking, the percentage, it's still a large enough percentage to matter. Now, let's look at something like 9/11. You know, it only cost $500,000 to do the damage that it did to New York City and the rest of the world. So when you implement a terrorist attack, they're not that expensive. You know, I spoke to Bill Martell, Professor Bill Martell, over at Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. He was one of my sources in the book. He was saying that, you know, overall it only costs, you know, anywhere between, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars to do, you know, tens of millions and billions of hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage, and even looking at the PR aspect of it too, to get to you know, have your name attached to a terrorist attack like, you know, like 9/11, or even more recently, look at what happened in New York City in Times Square. You know that, you know, with the Times Square bomber, I mean, that bomb didn't go off, but it only cost him overall less than $10,000 to, you know, get the car, get the bomb, you know, get money via Hawala from his contacts overseas in Pakistan, and to, you know, basically implement this mission that he was going to set off a detonate a bomb in Times Square. So it's not a lot of money to fund a terrorist attack. So,
and when you think about it, when you think about the fact that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have totaled about $1 trillion, you spend $500,000 as a terrorist and you watch the country that you're attacking bankrupt itself.
Exactly. I mean, I was in New York City during 9/11. Our entire city shut down. I mean, financial markets were at a standstill for a couple days. That's a lot of money for just $500,000 worth of damage. And it's, I think that's the point too. It doesn't cost that much to really implement this. So overall, yes, you know, in terms of terrorist funding, you know, drug trafficking is probably the most, you know, where they're getting the most of the money. But this is also a way where these terrorists are infiltrating our country from the inside out, number one, and these people that are affiliated to these terrorist groups are able to do it and really go under the radar because there's not a lot of federal regulation on stolen merchandise. I mean, it's changing and people are trying to change that. But right now people think of it as just, you know, a theft. It's shoplifting. That's it. But when you're shoplifting millions of dollars worth of items, I mean, even they don't even look at it. You know, yes, it might be a grand larceny, but it takes so much time and paperwork to really prove this. And I think this is a great example. We were staking out this deli in Queens, and you know, I was talking to my contact who I was with, and I was asking him, you know, why are we staking this deli out? Now, this guy had hordes of Prilosec OTC. Okay, so that's, you know, antacid medicine. You take that when you have, you're stressed out or, you know, your stomach hurts or whatever. And he, what he was doing was hoarding this Prilosec OTC and selling that on the black market. And how we were able to figure that out is that you would see these trucks kind of come around the back and basically load up his store from the back and take boxes of these Prilosec OTC, you know, just boxes and boxes of them in these cardboard boxes and put them downstairs in his basement. Well, when the sting actually happened, the guy, you know, they took all the Prilosec OTC and they were able to subpoena his accounts. He had something like $14 million in his bank. And my contact who I was speaking to was saying to me, at the FBI was saying to me, this guy wasn't making $14 million just by selling 40s of beer in his deli.
Right.
You know, this guy was set that $14 million. Now, did this guy ever go to jail? No, because what was going on, the Queens DA in New York City, there was so much paperwork, they didn't want to go ahead and implement it, they just let it go. So that's what the problem is.
There was too much paperwork for them to prosecute?
According to my source, yes. That's exactly why they let this guy go. So we sat there, we watched the sting happen, we watched this all go down, but they never prosecuted him.
We're talking to Heetha Prabhakar about her book, Black Market Billions, How Organized Retail Crime Funds Global Terrorists. So let's talk a little bit about the process that you went through of putting this book together, of writing this book. I mean, as you said, you start out, somebody wrote you an email or a chat or something offering you a handbag.
And I am, yes. And it was the day after Christmas. He was on instant message with me and wanted me to buy this handbag.
Right. And so you say, okay, there's something big here, follow the money.
Right.
What did you do next?
Well, at that point, I sort of deep dived and did a lot of research. I wanted to know exactly. I knew that more people were involved in organized retail crime. What the guy said in my chat was basically this, that everyone was doing it. A lot of employees at the store were involved in it. Some get caught, some don't. But this is happening all the time. So when you hear something like that, if it's happening all the time, I wanted to see exactly how rampant it was. Is it just happening in these luxury stores, or is it really happening all over the place all the time? So as I sort of did more deep diving and research into it, you know, in my coverage, I always cover retail from a very corporate level. I look at earnings. I talk to CEOs. They weren't going to be the ones that were going to tell me what was going on, you know, behind the scenes of their company. So I started contacting the loss prevention contacts that I knew.
Now, loss prevention is an industry all its own.
I mean, oh, yeah. Very interesting, loss prevention. I mean, there's stores, retailers have a whole segment of their balance sheets dedicated to loss prevention and shrink. I don't know if you've heard that term before, but that's really talks about, that really means the amount of merchandise that's coming out of the stores that's getting stolen. And stores budget for that, which is crazy. So every year, stores budget for a certain amount of items to just get stolen. It's just loss, shrink. So there are departments in these retailers that totally focus on just preventing shrink from happening. But as, again, we're talking about the recession, you know, as stores started realizing that they weren't, you know, consumers weren't coming in as often, they had to cut back on their budgets, loss prevention was the first to go. And therefore, these organized retail crime groups saw a little inside, you know, a sort of pocket into getting into these stores. When there are not a lot of security guards in these stores, there are not a lot of people watching them, what are you going to do? It makes it easy to go in and steal merchandise. So I started talking to, you know, people at the National Retail Federation, Joe LaRocca, who was in charge of that. You know, we really started kind of, he was telling me more information, and the Retail Industry Leaders Association, they were very instrumental in, you know, getting me contacts, especially in the public sector. This book wouldn't have been written without the help of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also the LAPD. I think I mentioned that to you before. The LAPD were letting me kind of come inside that world where they really focus in on this on a large level, and they let me spend time with them. They let me go on stings with them. I was in the back of a cop car. That the way I explained it to my friends, it was like being in that movie Training Day with nicer cops and a chatty Indian girl. I mean, we didn't know where we were going. This car was, you know, unmarked. It was, you know, sort of this like, you know, 1990 Oldsmobile or something. It was sort of broken down, and they were driving me all around downtown Los Angeles, and I was able to see it from their perspective and exactly how much, you know, what constitutes as a big sting and what they would go after and what kind of merchandise they were looking at. And I think that was what was so surprising, too, because, you know, initially from the get-go, I thought it was just expensive handbags. But what I realized, it was the smaller stuff that you were talking about, the Crest White Strips and the Prilosec OTC and jeans. I mean, that was another thing, too. And people are stealing jeans. You know, $3 million to sting cargo theft. That's another aspect of it, too. Cargo theft from trains and trucks where they stole $3 million worth of Levi's jeans. And they're about to sell that on the black market.
And as you pointed out in your book, for really high ticket items, you can put these, I forget what they're called, those little things on them that will buzz when you go out of the store. But for low ticket items, it's not worth it to do that because each of those little detector thingies costs $10 or $20.
Absolutely. Exactly. So it makes more sense if you have a $3,000 dress to put that sensor on. But, you know, for something like, you know, a box of, you know,
aspirin or toothpaste.
Exactly. Which may have, you know, retail value of $10 to $12. You know, if you want to put a sensor on that's going to, you know, cost them $5 to $7, you know, that's not really making them any money. I mean, the margin on that is very low. I mean, it's very narrow. Therefore, they don't want to necessarily do that. So what they do is that they budget for shrink, but then they realize that, whoa, hold on a second, our shrink is becoming enormous. You know, how are we going to mitigate that? And that's when, you know, I think then you see a lot of these people, a lot of these organizations, especially like the NRF and the Retail Industry Leaders Association.
NRF.
National Retail Federation, going in there and trying to really kind of go into Washington and say, hey, listen, you need to focus in on this. This is really important.
One of the things that's really interesting about it, too, is that the criminals who are doing this organized crime are often a step or two or more ahead of the of law enforcement.
Oh, yes.
Because they're so technologically savvy and they don't have any overhead and they don't have any bureaucracies.
There was this detective in the LAPD, Detective Guevara. I sat with him for a day or so and I asked him, I said, how am I going to be able to find out how these criminals are actually getting this done? He said, do yourself a favor. He's like, if you want to know where this money is going, he's like, you have to think like them. Go back to your hotel room, go back home, just write down every way that you could imagine that if you had to get a bunch of stolen items sold and really think out of the box. And that is how you're going to be able to think like them. And so that's exactly what I did. I thought of every possible way to get stolen items moved. And surprisingly, I mean, just because I'm online all the time and I'm always on Twitter and I'm on Facebook, I sort of went that way. And when I went back to him, he said, that's exactly what they're doing. What I call it is organized retail crime 2.0. You see, and again, a lot of, you know, maybe some of your listeners have kids and, you know, you see them sort of on Facebook or, you know, on this thing called New Life or Exact Life or I'm blanking on the name of it. But it's a virtual life, you know, where you could buy certain things.
Right.
And you have virtual wallets and stuff. That's ways that they're moving the money that they get from this. It's a way of laundering the money.
So that's a huge part of it. I mean, you steal a bunch of stuff, whether it be handbags, blue jeans, or Crest white strips, or Viagra, and then you have to sell it to somebody. What are the different ways that they do it?
Right. Okay, so you could either do it online. You know, you have, and now I have to say, eBay's been really good about sort of regulating this a little bit more. They have a...
But it must be so hard.
It is. And, you know, they wanted... when I was doing my research, you know, eBay obviously was the first place that I went to. And, you know, I met with them. And, you know, they really... I think because they've had such a problem with it, they now have a group headed by this guy named Paul Jones, who's brilliant and used to do loss prevention at The Limited. And, you know, this guy is really great. But he's now kind of... sort of overseeing that at eBay, because they've gotten so many complaints that this merchandise that was being, you know, that people were buying off of eBay was stolen. And, you know, eBay wants to be a legitimate retailer, and they want to be able, they want the public to trust them. I mean, they're only as good as their trustworthiness and the customer trusting them.
Who was complaining that it was stolen?
Well, the customers.
I mean, how did they know?
Well, it's interesting. When I was doing my research, I went on eBay and I looked up, you know, I looked up Prilosec OTC. Now, the way that I knew that it was stolen is because the price on it was so low. And I think what customers did in the past, and I think eBay is trying to, you know, change that because they want to be on par with what's, you know, the regular retail market, is that customers would go on and think, oh, well, eBay has the deals, quote unquote, the deals. They go on, they see boxes of Prilosec, or they see beauty products, for example. I, you know, my friends and I, we buy a lot of beauty products, right? They go on, they see shampoo that they use, Aveda shampoo, that's an example. They go on, they see shampoo that maybe costs $15 on there for $5. Well, oh my gosh, you know, I may be unemployed in the next couple months. You know, I don't know where my income is coming from. $5 Aveda shampoo, well, I want to still look pretty. You know, I'm going to go ahead and buy that. And in the past, eBay wasn't regulating that. But now because they want to be seen as a legitimate retailer, they're going to regulate it. And that's why they have people like Paul Jones. But there are things like Craigslist, for example, flea markets. You walk around in flea markets, you see all these stands. That's not regulated. You know, Facebook is now ramping up their retail side. They want people to go on there and use it as a marketplace. That isn't regulated. Places like that. So different B2B sites and different sort of auction sites, that's one way that they're doing it. And also, you know, offline, taking it offline, these flea markets. And that's one, that's a huge way. I mean, it's a sort of underground economy way of moving that merchandise.
Meanwhile, you have another phenomenon, which is if you want to get that money overseas, instead of bringing duffel bags full of cash, you've got gift cards and those little cards that contain money on them. And of course, you're going through customs. Nobody knows how much is on your card.
No, exactly. You know, I think the best way, you know, do you remember in Scarface, Tony Montana with that big duffel bag of money? The way the FBI explained it to me is that doesn't happen anymore. Yeah. I mean, that just isn't the case. I mean, maybe it does, you know, in like very random places. But, you know, if you're trying to move, you know, tens of millions of dollars of cash over the borders in the United States, gift cards, they look like your Amex card in your wallet. And you go through customs and there's no way to check.
Yeah, there's not a machine you can slide them through.
Slide them through, exactly. And, you know, I was just in India this time last year. No one in customs checked my wallet. Not that I was smuggling hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, back from India, but they didn't check my wallet. But also, and, you know, this is why I'm here in New Mexico talking about this, you know, when I was talking to the Albuquerque Police Department, who were another, it was another group that I, it was integral in me having, you know, getting this book written, but they told me that if I really wanted to see where a lot of the stolen merchandise was going, and now they're talking about stolen car parts.
And that's been a problem forever.
Forever. So one of the captains there told me to drive down to the border of Mexico and see for myself how easy it is to get merchandise across the border without any questioning. And he was right. You know, I stuffed, you know, the back of my car full of these duffel bags, you know, and garbage bags. You know, it looked like there was a bunch of stuff in there. And, you know, it was clothes and random stuff, but it looked, you know, sort of conspicuous. And I drove to the border, and the border agent asked me in Spanish if I had anything to declare. I said no, and I drove right on over, and that was it. No one said anything. And as I was there, and this was in Palomas, Mexico, you know, I took all this footage of all this merchandise that was being sold just right, literally 10 feet away from the U.S. border, of stolen car parts. That's what I couldn't believe. They're shiny and new, but it was everywhere from Mercedes car parts to, you know, your regular rims, and it was all there, just 10 feet over the U.S. border.
And these were from cars that were stolen whole. It wasn't that car parts were stolen, it was that cars were stolen.
Cars were stolen
and then disassembled
in Mexico and then sold piece by piece.
We're talking to Heetha Prabhakar about her book, Black Market Billions. So as I was reading this book, two things were happening. One was that in my nice little life, I've never had any contact that I know of with organized crime or organized criminals. And so my only points of reference for this are TV and the movies.
That you know of, though, Mary Charlotte.
That I know of.
You may have.
Yeah.
Do you go shopping at flea markets? Do you buy
Not
things at
lately,
discount?
Not lately, but I mean, I've seen these. We have the Santa Fe flea market. Who knows what's happening up there? I haven't
exactly.
been there in a while. Exactly. But it also, so I was thinking about how close is this to my life here in Santa Fe? I mean, we've got gangs here. We've got drug trafficking of various kinds here. I think we've got human trafficking here. But the other thing I was thinking about was this book paints such an ugly picture of the world that we're living in right now in so many ways. A picture in which there is so much basic fundamental economic and social injustice that leads to some of these things in the first place, that leads to terrorism, that leads to drug trafficking. Even small-time criminals who are not part of a really big organized network, they're living on the wages that are paid by these stores, which is not enough to live on. I mean, who wouldn't steal from them also?
Well, that, I think, is the part of the problem. I mean, when I was talking to these loss prevention executives, they were saying that a lot of these store employees feel that they deserve to steal items because they're not getting paid that much. And it's in their right to go ahead and steal items because they may be making minimum wage and that's it. Or maybe their salaries are based on sales and sales weren't really happening because no one was coming through those doors.
Because there was a global recession which was caused by those nuts on Wall Street.
Exactly, yeah. Or, you know, a global recession in general. And I think you're right, there is a cyclical pattern here. But I think why I wrote this book is because I wanted people, it wasn't to paint this terrible picture of the world, but I think in order for consumers to realize that this is happening, you almost have to paint it that way, just so people are aware. Yes, everyone wants to save money and get a discount on items and, you know, get more bang for their buck, but at the cost of potentially funding terrorist cells,
right.
It doesn't make any sense. And I think that's what I wanted to do here. And especially, you know, you have a family who wants to buy a Sony PlayStation 2 and they want to save a couple, you know, $100 or $200 and get that Sony PlayStation 2. And, well, I'm gonna retract that. Let me give you a better example, okay? So, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine and he was saying, I know what you're writing about in your book. I go down and get soap at discount on Broadway and 28th Street. It only costs me $10 and I get 20 bars of soap. What? So what? I'm getting it at a discount. Who is that hurting? That's the mentality that I wanted to change with this
right,
book.
Right.
That we're not hurting anyone because we're getting it at a discount and we're saving a buck. Like, if it's just me, it's no big deal. But if everyone is doing it all at the same time and supporting this, there's a problem.
And your book does tell people in many ways how to recognize it. You had a friend who was selling handbags and things on the street and didn't even have a stall. Was just basically standing on the street in some part of New York
right.
where they do that stuff.
Chris from the Congo. My contact, Chris from the Congo. Yeah, I met Chris when I was doing my research in Chinatown in New York. And he's not selling stolen items there, but he's really selling, his whole industry is counterfeit handbags. So that was just one aspect of the book. But what I thought was really interesting with Chris is that we had the cops. At one point, we were running from the cops.
You in four-inch heels.
In four-inch heels in the middle of the summertime, and that's always fun. So we were running from the cops there. But also, you know, I went to go visit him a couple months later on a Sunday, and I said, you know, Chris, everyone's sitting here selling their bags out in plain sight, and there's a cop right over there, and he goes, oh, that cop, he's a traffic cop. It doesn't matter. You know, he doesn't care. And that's the other thing, too. I think the NYPD and cops in general think that this problem is so rampant that they just, it's like a roach problem. They're like, oh, they're everywhere. We can't do anything about it unless it's a big bust. Unless it's a bust for $6 million, we're not going to do anything about it.
It's interesting to see this from the consumer point of view, and people rail against consumer culture. And sometimes I think, well, you know, we do have much nicer lives in so many ways than we had 100 years ago, in the sense that
that's true.
We can dress more warmly and get around by cars. And with everything that's made our life better, there's always a dark side to it.
Right.
But there is this question of how much stuff do we really need? Where does it come from? And, you know, that term kind of jumped out at me, aspirational shopper, somebody who wants a $1,000 handbag. Who in their right mind wants a $1,000 handbag? I'm sorry.
No, there are a million girls out there that do. But I got to tell you, after writing this book and after really focusing on that, I think me personally, my values changed. And I feel like a lot of people's values changed in the last 2 years. And when they realized, well, it was a matter of me eating or, you know, going shopping for that $250 to $500 item. The world changed when this recession happened, I think, on a larger level. And I think I want to think that people got more conscious. You know, everyone talks about the middle class disappearing and the, you know, the upper class, the rich is getting richer and the, you know, the 99%ers are getting, you know, more entrenched in their 99%. But I think with that comes a greater consciousness and people are beginning to realize, well, you know, yeah, what does aspirational mean? I feel like that definition might be changing a little bit now. You know, whereas it used to mean I need a $1,000 handbag, maybe it now means, well, maybe I'll go to Whole Foods and buy $40 worth of organic groceries and have a good meal with my family.
There's another piece of it, too, which is not really in the purview of your book, but it made me think about it, too, which is whether the handbag was counterfeit or whether it was real, it was probably made in a sweatshop.
Well, yeah, you know, I know for a fact that, you know, a company like Hermes, they handcraft all of their, you know, their bags. So, and I know that the Hermes workers get paid, you know, a solid amount of money. And, you know, I know that that's not sweatshop labor. And I could say the same thing for the Vuitton, you know, handbags. You know, where the Givenchy handbags are made and where the Lanvin handbags are made, I don't know.
And the blue jeans and the sneakers and all of these things that we do know about.
Right, right. I mean, you know, I think we have to be careful, though, because, you know, I think that, you know, while regulations are probably not as, you know, as, like, high level as they may be here in the United States as they are in China, you know, I think that, you know, companies are trying to regulate that more, and I'm not trying to advocate for corporate America or, you know, that kind of thing, but, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, in terms of sweatshop, yeah, I mean, there's a social aspect to it, too. You know, I think that look what happened with the Mike Dacey situation. You know, he pointed out all that information, all that stuff that was coming out of, you know, the Foxconn sweatshop, or the, I mean, I shouldn't call it a sweatshop,
factory,
it's a,
yeah.
The factory, you know, there was child labor and, you know, people, there were suicides, which had happened. But when he was there, he said that he witnessed all this stuff, and later to only, you know, have poor Ira Glass on his show have to retract all of that, along with New York Times and a lot of, news organizations that I listen to in New York City had to retract it. So you have to be careful, I think, when you want to, and I think that's what I learned here, too, while doing this book, like, you can't, you have to see it for yourself in order to believe it. And I think that's why I really wanted to follow that money trail myself, because I could sit there and read what Congress was saying. I could sit there and listen to what the FBI was saying, you know, because they want to get bills passed in Congress. They want funding to go their way. You know, National Retail Federation, you know, Retail Industry Leaders Association, I'm sure that they want funds allocated to them. And they could tell me what they wanted, you know, they tell me what they've been seeing. But until I went out and saw it for myself and realized, yes, what they were saying was actually true, I mean, that it wouldn't have happened. It was a level of journalism that I had to go to, where some maybe journalists don't go to and just sort of make assumptions. You know, I really had to see it for myself. So
we're talking to Heather Prabhakar about her book, Black Market Billions. There's one point that I want to make sure we talk about before we go, which is something that, I mean, it's one thing if you buy a counterfeit handbag. It's another thing if you buy counterfeit medicine. There are documented examples, which you talk about in the book, of people getting sick from medicine either that isn't real or that was stolen and then sat in the heat and degraded and
so
things
awful.
Like that. I mean, people are dying from...
People are dying, and that is another thing, too. I mean, that is just horrible to think that people, just to save a buck... I think I used the example of the baby formula, where my friend had gone and gotten baby formula for her infant, and her infant got sick. And she had gotten it off this, you know, cheap sort of one-off website because she thought she was getting a deal. I mean, this is a friend of mine who is, you know, upper middle class, wanted to save some money, was buying lots of infant formula, you know, just thought that, hey, this looks completely legit. And her baby ended up getting very sick. So if you could think about this person that just, you know, just like you and I, just wanted to go and, you know, save some money. And that's just infant formula. I mean, you can imagine if people really have, you know, drugs these days cost so much money. They, you know, I was watching, you know, something on television where this man was saying how he had to cut back on his drugs that he has to take every single day, you know, that cost him up to, you know, $1,500 out of pocket because he doesn't have health insurance. And these are the type of people that may or may not have health insurance or have to pay for things out of pocket, and they want to get a deal. Well, that fake medicine that's floating out there can really do some harm on that, and that's another aspect of this that really needs to get regulated. I mean, where, and it's interesting that we're talking about this now because I developed this iPhone app where I wanted to, I mean, I'm working with some with a bigger organization right now, but what we want the iPhone app to do, because people go shopping so much with their iPhones and their iPads, what we want it to do is to actually take a picture of an item, whether that's a camera or a handbag, or, you know, hopefully it will develop it even more so it'll be able to scan, you know, UPC codes of drugs and tell you whether it's fake or stolen. So we're working on that right now.
It's amazing.
The Black Market Billions app. You can see the 1.0 version of it on my website at heathaprabhakar.com. But we're working on that. So we can put it back into the hands of the consumer so the consumer can get protected and be protected.
Exactly. And when you look at the big picture, I mean, everything comes down to demand. There's no
absolutely
drug trafficking if there's no demand. If there were universal health insurance that covered your drugs, there wouldn't be the demand for black market drugs. You know, all of these things go together.
Or if there was more money, if drugs were less expensive. I mean, what's the markup on the drugs? I mean, what are these drug companies doing to these are even cancer drugs. They cost so much money out of pocket. And I thank God every day that I have good health insurance, because if I didn't, and God forbid something happened to me, you know, there'd be a big problem.
And somebody is getting very wealthy while somebody else is going bankrupt.
I mean, there's that aspect too. But, you know, what I really think is most important is that the consumer just needs to be aware, and they have to take it into. They can't be. With this book, I wanted to show the consumer that they can't be a passive consumer anymore. You know, we have Michael Pollan that says, look at what we eat. You know, he came out with that book, you know, Omnivore's Dilemma. He really wanted you to be conscious about what you eat and where that food comes from. I'm telling the consumer right now, you need to be conscious about where your products come from. You've got to be conscious whether or not they're stolen, whether or not they're fake. Take an active approach to what you are doing and what you are buying. You're only going to save yourself with that.
And if you buy from a reputable, either online or in your town retailer, you're probably okay. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But there were some instances, which, I mean, I don't mean to scare the consumer out there, especially in Santa Fe, but there were some instances where some Walgreens were actually buying their product back, stolen merchandise, from these illegitimate warehouses because they wanted to save a buck on bulk items. So there's that aspect too. I mean, some of these, and you don't know where these warehouses are storing them. What we really need to do as consumers is really, again, take a very active approach and kind of put pressure on Washington to have more regulation on this. And, you know, either whether we do it through an iPhone app or whether we do it through letters or whether we just do it personally and say, hey, listen, you know, if you don't have some sort of regulation on your item, whether it's a UPC code, whether it's the $5 more and having that sensor on there to tell me that this is actually legitimate, you know, I'm not going to buy it. And I think that's where we're going to be able to fix that.
Heather Prabhakar is a journalist and Bloomberg TV correspondent. She's author of the new book, Black Market Billions, How Organized Retail Crime Funds Global Terrorists. And she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night here in Santa Fe at 6 o'clock in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you so much.